Okay, so the demo schedule sheet is coming. I forgot to bring it. That's why I was just calling somebody from my office to print it and bring it. So you will sign up once it shows up. And then the project is apparently the write-ups are all due today, right? That's the deal. So please give them to me now so that anybody who comes late, they are already late. Let's be mean towards the end of the semester. Okay. Yeah, so a friend of mine sent this, and you can pretty much guess which organization this friend is working for. Can you guess? If you look at that, which organization my friend must be working for? NASA, right? So, and my own feeling was I told him that we could have used $17 billion to get AIG working for another 1 week, and we are wasting all that money on NASA. You know, it's just a useless thing. Anyway, that's the current state of the budget. What I really like, I'm not quite sure, there's a total defense funding, and this is nice. Interest on debt is $615 billion. And, you know, this would be actually off the scale next year onwards because we have a trillion or so bailouts. But then, you know, there is defense spending, there is Department of Defense, and there is War on Terror. So obviously NASA would have a better chance if they say, we're going to stop the aliens from invading the Earth. So suddenly they can be in the War on Terror department and they can get a lot more money than what they're getting. Anyway, so this is in today's class, I'm going to talk about the rest of the information integration. And then as I said, next class, any leftover topics plus a review. And by that time, you should have had your blog question answered so that we'll know what actually, you know, made it to your heads. Okay. Any questions before I start? Thank you. Is this all?
That's what you sent to Tuesday.
Okay, Monday and Tuesday. Yes, thanks. So what should I do? I should just randomly pick somebody and then, because I know that the first people get the choice slots, but I can't stop it. So anybody who's not getting this to them, you know, I'm sure they're going to come in the weekend at 12 night, 12 in the midnight. But anyway, please write your, you know, pick your slot and write the thing and then give it to me by the end of the class. Are there any questions before we do the rest of the discussion on query processing for information integration? Okay, so the one thing that I forgot to mention, I guess, with sufficient emphasis last time, is that part of the reason we are interested in information integration is also because the crawled pages, the pages that we crawl to, you know, that Google search engines, et cetera, crawl, that's just a small part of the web. At least according to various estimates. Many sites essentially are database-backed sites, and these are huge, humongous data sources. And if you just count the raw bytes of information, you know, then the stuff that these databases contain is about 80% of the web, and the 20% is what you're actually seeing, you know, written by you in hand. So part of the reason why information integration, there is a lot of interest in that, is hopefully you can discover these sources and you can use them. Which, I mean, there's nothing new here. I mean, it's just that last time I was already saying we want to talk about mediator architectures. Yeah, this is a nonsensical animation. I was supposed to not show you first and ask you and then show you, but anyway. So So there are lots and lots of them, so it's not an obvious thing. If you think about it, you would have said maybe thousands of them, but it's like 25 million or so. Which reminds me on a different note, talking about the budget, that Carl Sagan should have been alive now. I mean, you know, I no longer have any interest in any number that doesn't end in a billion, thanks to all the bailouts. And Carl Sagan is the guy who used to talk about billions and billions of stars out there. How many of you know Carl Sagan? Again, I don't know why I teach this class. I should get some older people, or at least people who actually see things. But anyway, so there are millions and millions of sites over there in the deep web, and you know, and so in fact, you could potentially use them, you know, in this information integration kind of a scenario. So that's just something that I wanted to mention, because the deep web is a word that you hear a lot, and deep web means these supposedly structured sources which are accessible on the web, but they have to be used in a different way than the normal pages, because, you know, you ask more questions to them, you get more answers, okay, and so they really should be mediated over. Okay, so what we were doing last time was we were talking about, we come up to here and we said we'll start talking about query reformulation and optimizing access to sources. That's what I'm going to do today. And then depending on the time, I'll get into supporting imprecision and incompleteness. If not, we'll do that part next class. Okay. So we started from larger, you know, like a stratospheric level in terms of what's the right architecture for integrating sources, and we talked about different kinds of sources, I mean, different kinds of architectures. We also talked about the many dimensions that can make a difference in terms of these architectures, you know, whether the sources are autonomous, whether you're doing vertical versus horizontal integration, so many of these things. Now I'm coming to a very specific part, which is assuming I picked the mediator model, assuming that the schema mapping has already been done. So that means we know essentially, no, assuming that I pick the mediator model and I know what my sources are, all I need to do right now is to register my sources onto my mediator schema. Okay, so the question then is, so basically if I have multiple sources that are being accessed by the mediator, and you know essentially the connection between which attributes correspond to which attributes in the mediator schema, but still you want to actually, there is a question of how do you express these sources in terms of the mediator schema, okay? This is like a very small sub-question, but it's interesting to kind of sink teeth into it, because even there it turns out there are differing trade-offs in terms of how you represent these mappings, okay? So if I have a mediator, and so think of this as some sort of an outsourcing model, right? I mean, there are all these contractors, and then you take jobs, and then you throw it to the contractors. Okay, now the question, of course, and then so basically you're taking queries and you're sending them to the sources and you're collating their answers and sending them back. Okay, so if I'm trying to figure out, you know, I, the mediator, need to have some notion of how my schema corresponds to the source's schema. Okay, what is the mapping? Okay, now there are multiple ways of doing it. Before doing it, let's think in terms of what should be the desiderator, and what should you make sure will hold, okay? One is expressive power. You should be able to differentiate between different kinds of sources, okay, rather than say all of them are equally, I mean, they're all just book sources. You might want to say, this is a book source that mostly is about CS books. This is a book source that's mostly about Westerns or something. Okay, so the more you can differentiate between sources, the better off you are, because rather than send each query to everybody and say, guys, wake up, we got a query, just answer it, you want to just pick the sources that are actually relevant for the query. Okay, the more you can differentiate between them, you know, their capabilities, the better off you are in calling the right source. Okay. Easy addition. Presumably, if you're a mediator, you know, you may wind up getting more and more sources added on. You know, in fact, in a case of ad hoc integration, you might just decide after the query comes which sources you add. Okay? The point, of course, is that you don't have, it should not be the case that a major amount of changes have to be made just to add one extra source. Okay, that makes sense. Reformulation, in the sense, if I get a query in, it should be straightforward to reformulate into subqueries to the sources. Okay, the reason I bring this all up is we'll see that these two, for example, easy addition and reformulation wind up being opposing each other. Okay, we'll talk about two mappings. One allows easy reformulation, but it's bad for addition of new sources. The other allows easy addition, but it's harder for reformulation. Harder in a computational sense, that means it can actually be intractable to reformulate the query exactly onto the sources. Okay. And then the final thing, an important issue too, is it, if possible, you would like it to be non-lossy. Okay. Many people don't have middlemen or the intermediaries because they think if they go directly to the source, they can get a better deal. Right? How many of you, many people, I don't know if they still do it or not now, they'll use Expedia to figure out what the best deals are and then go to the actual air flight sources, the actual airlines to get $5 or $6 extra savings. Okay, so in some sense, you know, it's a non-lossy integration because there are better deals available at the source and the integrator is not showing it to you. Okay, now in this case, in fact, a more interesting scenario is you could have gotten more answers. I mean, it's one thing that, you know, having less number of saving a couple of dollars, saving $5 on the reservation fees. More interesting is some of the flights may not even be shown by the mediator. In that case, you are forced to go to the individual airline sources. So if you have a mediator, for you to trust the mediator and not, you know, go over them to the actual sources, it would be nice if they are non-lossy. That means the answers you would get if you went here would be the same as the answers you would get when you went through here. This is what you would like, you know. It may or may not be possible, but these are the kinds of properties that you would like to have. Okay. So now, if I'm in terms of mapping the data sources onto the mediator schema, it turns out that the easiest way to think about this is in terms of views, database views, on which we spent at least a couple of minutes when we were talking about databases, right? So a view is really just a query. Okay, on the database. Okay, and then there are two types of views we talked about. Virtual views, where essentially it's just a named query, and it doesn't exist. In the sense that the data corresponding to that query doesn't exist. You can use this named query as a named macro in your other queries, and then essentially at the runtime, you know, you just replace the macro with the view. That would be the virtual view. The other idea is a materialized view, where in fact you would run this query, get all the tuples, store it in a local database. That would be a materialized view. Okay? Now, of course, you can talk about what's the differences between, what are the trade-offs in terms of if you actually have a database, a real database, onto which you are defining views, you can talk about the trade-offs between defining virtual views on that existing database versus defining materialized views on that existing database. For example, if you define materialized view, then if the database changes, then your view is stale now. Right? But then if the database doesn't change, then a virtual view is going to be recomputing the answer every time, whereas a materialized view has it locally. Okay, so you understood views on a database which exists. Now all you need to do is ignore the database. Think of only views, but database doesn't exist. Okay, this is sort of like that thing that Partha was pointing out about Einstein's cat. Wireless is like I don't know if you guys remember, but Einstein apparently once explained that this idea of telegraphy can be thought of as you have a long cat, whose hindsight, the behind is in Los Angeles, the front is in New York, and then you pull the tail in Los Angeles, then it says meow on New York, and that's how the telegraphy works. Now that you understood telegraphy, wireless telegraphy is exactly the same except there's no cat. Okay, And similarly, now that you understood, you know, views on an existing database, mapping the sources onto a mediator database is nothing but views, except there is no database anymore. Okay, the mediator doesn't exist actually. The mediator database doesn't exist. Okay, but you are writing views on it. Okay, there are two ways of doing it. One is you can say the mediator database itself is a view on the sources. So in essence, the mediator database, which doesn't exist, is really a virtual view on the union of all the sources it can access. Okay? Now, that basically, the advantage of this is that as soon as the source comes, the mediator is just a namesake standing there. As soon as the source comes, a query comes, you quickly actually shift the queries to the sources. We'll see, you know, more detail as to how that view works. But here, actually, global as view is mediator schema is being expressed as a virtual view on the source schema. Okay, and the other idea is to do the opposite. Let's think of the sources as the views on the database that doesn't exist. Okay, but that you could imagine the following way. At one time, before the history started, there used to be a big database in the world. And all these sources went and took some number of tuples from them and then just stored it. Right, this is sort of like the Fahrenheit 451, right? Is it 411 or 451? 451, yeah. Kind of a thing. So you went into the existing database that existed at one time and each source filled itself to its brim. Okay, so they're all materialized now. Now the database disappeared. So if you want to reconstruct the database, all you have are pieces of the database. Do you understand what I'm saying? So now you can say each source is really a piece of the mediator database, which only exists in these sources. The rest of the database is gone. Okay? So here, of course, sources as materialized view on the mediator database, and here it is mediator schema as virtual view on the source schema. Okay? Now, it's a simple enough idea, so we'll go a little more deeper into this. Now it turns out, I must say, while this interesting discussion, and I think, you know, anytime you hear about information integration in any textbook, they'll talk about this stuff. Okay, so I think I should explain at least part of it to you. But I should also mention that, remember we talked about horizontal versus vertical data integration. Okay, horizontal means essentially you get joins happening. Vertical means mostly you are removing duplicates or aggregating data from multiple sources. Now, vertical data integration also can be thought of as data aggregation. Which basically all you are saying is that there are multiple sources of a particular type, and then, like, you know, multiple bookstores, for example. And then you're trying to find the cheapest price for this book. Are you trying to find all the books that are available that are written by this particular author among all the bookstores? Okay, that would be a special class of the overall information integration because it only does horizontal. Okay, and it turns out that most of the information integration scenarios that exist right now, for which actually there's work right now, tend to be data aggregation scenarios. Okay, and for data aggregation, the difference between global as view and local as view is not particularly much. Okay, so here is a interesting, you know, here we are going to split, which it doesn't have to be split at all if all you can do is data aggregation. Okay, but I will, with that caveat, I will still explain to you how these two differ in the general integration scenario where you might do both horizontal and vertical integration together. But then after that is over, I'll actually talk mostly about optimization in the data aggregation scenarios because that's what is being done a lot more right now. Okay. So for the global as view, so here are some sources. I made up some, you know, an example. So I have decided my mediator schema is going to be movie relation which has title, director, year, and genre. Okay. And then schedule relation, which has the cinema where the movie is playing, the title of the movie that is playing, and the time at which that movie is playing. This is the schema for my mediator. So this is what I want to allow other people to ask questions on. So all the questions will be in terms of movie and schedule now. Now then I went into the world and found there are three sources, S1, S2, S3. Okay? And I have basically done schema mapping already. And so I have realized that S1 has something, 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 but the first thing is title, the second thing is corresponds to director, third thing corresponds to year, fourth thing corresponds to genre. So I've already done the mapping. So you notice that that hard problem is gone, and what's interesting is even after that hard problem is gone, there's still another hard problem left. That's what we're discussing right now. Okay? So S1 has title, director, year, genre. S2 has title, director, year, genre. S3 has just title and director. S4 has just title, year, and genre. I could have this, right? There are multiple sources. Different people just make up sources about movie information. My question is, if all of these are accessible, how do I essentially, you know, the mediator wants to provide services to the outside world, saying, I'm going to take all your queries on this, and you don't need to go here. I'll directly answer your queries, essentially. Okay. So the first global view, what we need to do is we need to define movie itself as a named view on S1, S2, S3, S4. Okay? And it would basically be a named unioned view. Okay, so in particular, it will look like this. So create view for movie as select all the tuples from S1, select all the tuples from S2, union them, and then basically do a join on S3 and S4. Because this guy gives title and director, this guy gives title, year, genre. So if you join over the title, then you get title, director, year, genre. Okay, not particularly hard, what I'm saying, right? So if I just union it this way, then I essentially have defined the existing, the mediator's relations are now views on the source relation. This is global as view. This is just defining a macro, that's all. Okay, now the advantage of this is that as soon as there is a query on movie, users give a query on movie, and then as soon as the user looks that side, you substitute movie with this particular query. That's how, you know, it's a virtual view, right? It's a virtual view. So there is, the reformulation is basically obvious. It's just macro expansion. Okay. Now the other way of doing it is local as view, where exactly I have the same movie and schedule as the mediator schema. Suppose I still have, now this time I change the sources for some reason. So I have S1 title, director, year, genres, S3 has title and director, S5 has title, director, year, and but year has to be greater than 1960. Okay? So then what I would do is all I need to do is write S1 as a view on this, S3 as a view on this, S5 as a view on this. So create source S1 as basically taking some tuples from the movie database. How many tuples? Just some tuples. Remember, I told you that the way of thinking about materialized sources is there used to be a big database. Sources went and picked up some tuples and came home. Okay? One of the interesting things is if they picked up all the movie tuples from the big database, then you don't need any more sources. Okay, this becomes an optimization issue. But nobody will ever tell you that they have less than the total number of movies in the world on the internet. I mean, on internet, you'll never put up a source saying, oh, don't come to me, I have very, very little information. You would always overclaim. Okay, but let's leave that at this point and let's assume that. So S1 can essentially be seen as selection of tuples from the movie relation. And S3 is seen as selection of title and director only from the movie relation. And S5 is seen as selection of title, director, year from the movie relation where year has to be greater than 1960. And if I really want to say only, so actually, no, in fact, that's all I want to say. If this is the S5, then this part isn't there. Genre comedy is not a constraint that I required on S5. Okay, so I'm writing each of the sources as views on a database that doesn't exist anymore. Now the interesting thing is, if in fact somebody says, give me the movies, give me all the movies you know about, okay? What's interesting now is you need to figure out, first of all, which of the sources are relevant, okay? And also whether you should call all of them or just a subset would be enough for optimality reasons, okay? And so this business about optimizing, we'll talk about in a minute. You know, basically that requires us to differentiate between the coverage of a source with respect to a relation. Okay, we'll talk about that in a little while. But since I talked about local as view and global as view, and I told you how to do this, and in fact this is one of the homework questions, so you know, those of you who are asleep by now because you apparently were working on the project last night, still wake up because you only have like a weekend to do the project and the homework. What I would like to point out to you is at least one example where these are very different. They actually have differences in the capabilities they provide. Okay? So consider the following scenario where I have movie, title, director, year, genre, schedule, cinema. This is still again the same mediator schema. Now I only have one source in my world. Just one source. It is basically telling me which movie theaters play what genre of cinema. So for example, the art theater right down there in Mill Avenue, it plays artsy movies. So it will say, you know, Valley Art Theater, artsy movies. And then it will say some other theater, only Westerns. That's the kind of source you have right now. And this is the only source you have. This is your mediator schema. How do you represent this mediator schema in terms of these sources? You know, again, think of the outsourcing model. If you have a bunch of employees whose capabilities you are trying to sell to customers, okay, and you have this crazy employee who knows half of software writing, half of management, and one third of something else. So you can't put them as, oh, this guy is a software guy. You can't do that. You can't say they are just management people. They basically cross boundaries. So how do you represent their capabilities so that if there is a God-made task just for this guy, and you don't realize it, and you don't say, yeah, yeah, we can do this because we have a guy who can do this for you, then you lose the ability to, you know, make that customer happy. And that customer would actually go behind your back to the source, which is this employee, and they say, yeah, I can do this. That would be non-lossy mediation. Right? I mean, outsourcing is hard. You guys think outsourcing is just a bad thing, but it's also hard. You know, you need to know, you know, what the capabilities are of the people who you're managing, of the, you know, sources you're managing in this case. So I have source S4. So if I'm doing global as view, what would I do? This is the best I can do. Basically, I have to write movie as a view and schedule as a view. That's all I can do. Okay? Now, movie is basically a view on S4, except what happens is if I take stuff from S4, then I will get null, null, null for the first three tuples. Because I don't know which particular values are the title, director, year for the genre that it's showing. Okay, and similarly for the schedule, I'll have cinema null null. By the way, null in database terminology means I don't know the value. It can be pretty much anything. In fact, nulls are interesting. We'll talk about this again either towards the end of today's class or the beginning of next class. When you say a database is incomplete, that means essentially some columns it has no values. For certain tuples, in some columns there are no values. What that would mean then is that that tuple could be a stand-in for a union of full tuples. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so, and so in fact, basically this one tuple corresponds to any possible instantiation of these nulls with the genre being that genre. And in fact, you can even, that's sort of a non-deterministic interpretation. And if you actually know the probabilities as to what are the probabilities that these attributes will take these values together, then in essence, individual incomplete tuple corresponds to a probability distribution over complete tuple. I'll talk about all of this in a minute again. Okay, I have decided to do the most deepest things on the day after the project because that makes the exam setting much easier. So we'll talk about the probabilistic databases in a while again, but you know, in this particular case, you got this. That's okay. But the problem is the following. Suppose I want to find out which cinemas are playing comedies. I can answer that by going here. Now I have a middleman. I'm sunk because the middleman has no idea of answering that query. Do you see that? Because nulls cannot be joined. Okay? So I said non-lossy versus lossy mediation. Here is a classic case of lossy mediation. I mean, I made up an example, but it tells you that at least theoretically it is possible to lose the information about the sources when you did global as view. Yes?
But are you trying to say that each and every source must have qualified schema at least?
Yes. By the time you came here, each of the sources have schema, and you know how the attribute names here correspond to the attribute names here. You know it. It's just a question of expressing the mapping. So this is why I'm doing it here after having discussed the schema mapping and the data alignment, which I didn't quite discuss in full length, but I assume by the time I come here that the names are all, you know, essentially if I call this cinema dash, I at least know cinema dash corresponds to cinema. It's just a question of whether I want to express this as a view on this or vice versa. So I came down to that point. It turns out even there are interesting issues. Yes, sir. Yeah, right?
Yeah,
that is possible. That's a very good point. That's an extremely good point. That is possible. So what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is you're changing your description of the company every time you buy an employee, you get an employee. So as soon as you join Intel, suddenly they will change the description of the company. Now we have this other kind of a guy. We forgot to tell you, so we'll change it in the front page itself. You know, Intel is everything plus this other guy. Okay, so it's a very, very good point. This is not an, you know, not a hard to solve problem, but the obvious way to solve it essentially means you keep changing the mediator schema. That makes no sense. If every time you add a source, you have to change the mediator schema, remember the mediator schema is what is being shown to the customers. Okay, they shouldn't have to read your company webpage every day to see is Intel still selling, you know, the other kind of chips or the potato chips, right? I mean, they should know upfront. So the stability is an issue. The modularity is an issue. Okay, if you don't mind modularity, if you can keep changing mediated schema, then you can change this and you will basically, now the what's interesting, of course, is if you're in the business of making new relations, why not make a new relation called S1 relation? Do you understand what I'm saying? So I am starting an extremely new outsourcing company, okay? So I will basically tell all the people here, you know, I'm from India, so I can outsource. I'll say, I can provide you the capabilities of Ram, Lakshman, and you know, all the names of the people I know in India. And you have no clue what they actually do. So if you have to figure that out, you know, you may as well go talk to them. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's a very interesting point. I mean, you can solve this, but the way of solving it turns out to lead you to ruin because you change the description of the mediator. That's one thing you shouldn't change. You should think, you should stick to it. Okay? The other point, the other way of doing it in this case, for example, in the localized view mediation, this is not a problem at all. It turns out that you can create source S4 as a view on the mediator schema. And you don't need to change the mediator anymore. Okay? Now, so just to summarize this, globalized view is not modular because in addition of new sources, we'll have to change the mediator schema or you become lossy. Or you could become lossy. Okay? Localized view is more modular. Okay. can be awkward to write. Basically, this is connected. So to avoid lossiness, you have to be very careful in writing the view of the global schema as exactly the tight view of all the sources. It's more flexible from the localized views point of view. And essentially, it has the power of the entire query language available to describe sources. A source is just an arbitrary query on the original schema. So any source, any query you can write can be a source. So at least that many you can write. Now for the other side, query reformulations in the globalized view are extremely easy because it's just expansion of macros. Localized view, query reformulation is hard. How hard? It can be intractable. It can be NP-hard. Okay, because it turns out this corresponds to the fundamental problem of answering queries using only views. You guys know from the database literature, database course, that you can answer queries with a database and you can answer them faster using views if the database also is there. But if the database is gone, it took a vacation, and all that's left is pieces of it that were materialized. How do you answer the query while giving guarantees that you have given all possible tuples you could have given? Do you understand what I'm saying? So it turns out that you could not have done any more by directly going to the sources. And to give that guarantee, getting the exact rewritings of the queries in this kind of context would be NP-hard. Okay. About the only reason I went through this, despite the fact that I told you that most work only just uses data aggregation scenarios, is that if this is possible in a sort of an intra-corporate scenario where you have like only 10 real data sources and you want to somehow properly integrate them, which one should you use? Okay, actually tell me, which one should you use? In an intra-corporate scenario, you have 10 databases. What would be the best way to write the mediator schema, as global as view or local as view?
Global
as view. Why? Because the sources don't keep changing. And you can look at all the sources once, decide what your mediator schema is going to be, and write your web page saying this is what I'll give you. Okay? Whereas on the web scenarios where more sources can be added, global as view is not as good. Okay, so when if the global as view is best, when there are few sources that are stable and also they are well known to the mediator. Local as view is better. There are many unknown data sources and they can keep coming in as time goes on, and you don't want to keep changing your mediator. You know, you decide as a company what you're going to sell, and then as new sources come in, you just write them as views on what you want to sell. So if you join Intel, right, and you also know how to make kites, okay, the only part of your capability that Intel will put still on its web page is that you know something about the right kind of chips, not that you know how to eat potato chips or how to make kites. That part, they are not going to sell. So you can have a separate consultancy business outside from Intel where you can sell that competence. Okay? So now what's interesting is that I can spend now, you know, another half an hour or so talking about why in fact reformulations are hard for local as view and giving some interesting theoretical details. I won't do it because I already told you, A, because you're already falling asleep, and B, because I already told you that more action is in the data aggregation scenarios. So having said these distinctions, and also having pointed out that for data aggregation, there's not that much of a difference between global as view, local as view. Now let me go on to the second part, which is optimizing access to sources. Okay? This is kind of interesting, where assuming that you have reformulated, if you know how to reformulate, the question then is you want to run the query fast. In database management, you know, much of your time is spent on optimizing queries. Okay. So the question is, what would be the issues involved in optimizing queries in this kind of scenarios, this kind of mediator architecture? Okay. And I will particularly focus on a special case to make things simpler, where in fact it's a data aggregation scenario. So if you're forgetting, if, you know, think of, let's say, a simple mediator which tells you about all the CS papers. Okay, or a simple mediator which tells you about all the, you know, products, okay, and their prices. So data sources are more or less of the same class, and what you're trying to do is aggregate their results together. Okay? So even there, it turns out that there are interesting issues to talk about from optimization point of view. For those of you especially who are from database background, there are interesting issues to talk about. One of which is, so let's look at this. From the point of view of databases, there's only one optimization criteria, normal traditional databases, which is everybody is supposed to give the correct answer. Precision one, recall one. So the only way you are different from another database manager is you're faster than them, or you're slower than them, in which case you're worse. Or you, you know, the only way one query plan could be different from another query plan is because this one is slower than the other one. Okay. Now it turns out that once you think in terms of, you know, sort of integration scenarios, web-oriented integration scenarios, there are many more issues that get opened up. First of all, precision one, recall one makes no sense. Okay. So you no longer just think in terms of total time of execution. You're also interested in the cost to the first few tuples, for example. So if there is a difference, if there are two sources, one of which takes 3 days and gives 10 tuples, another gives you one tuple, you know, every 12 hours, or you know, one tuple in the beginning and one tuple little later, one tuple little later, you're more likely to hang around with the second one because at least it's giving some results. Okay, so you may, if there are two different query plans, one of, both of which, in fact, either, you know, this one actually gets done faster, but this one starts giving results out faster. In a normal database scenario, clearly you go with this. But if you are interested in users, even in the case of databases, okay, then you need to start talking about the output rate. Now, is this just something I'm making up, or in fact, are there algorithms that you might be aware of that differ in whether or they do it fast versus whether they start giving answers fast? It turns out there are many join algorithms, you know, in databases. In fact, there's like a whole cottage industry of join algorithms, okay? And you always just looked at them in terms of which is faster. But now you can start looking at them in terms of which will start giving tuples faster. And the comparison is different. And in fact, once the databases on the web came along, there are a whole sort of new kinds of join algorithms that have been written up, which would not have made sense at all if you have a single database right under your control. But it makes a lot of sense because you have a whole bunch of unreliable data sources. Okay, a classic case in point, for example, is when you're trying to join two sources, neither of which are next to you. Okay, you get tuples from here, you get tuples from here, and join. You know, one type of join algorithm gets all the tuples from here, keeps them in the local buffer, gets a tuple from there, and starts joining. Now, suppose it takes 3 days to get all the tuples from this guy. So you wait patiently for 3 days before you, even a single tuple starts coming out. A much better idea is start getting tuples from both of them. And as soon as two tuples come, try to see if they can be married. Join is a marriage, right? And then you'll have a result. Okay? These kinds of join algorithms are, you know, are interesting because you are looking at cost to few tuples has to be optimized, as again, it's just cost to the end of the execution. Furthermore, much more interesting is coverage of the plan. Since you are no longer talking about recall has to be one, okay, recall doesn't have to be one because you can't actually, you know, especially in a scenario where all you have is basically there may be situations where you know there is some idea of all the movies that were made in the world, okay, but then you only have three sources in front of you. None of them may actually together have all the movies that were made in the world. So even if you call them all, you don't expect recall 100%. Okay, and furthermore, one of these sources is extremely slow. Okay, in the old days when there used to be, I think, after Napster and before they closed all the file sharing systems, I'm sure you have seen file sharing systems where this person would have everything available for download. Okay, but the latency is 3 to 10 days. Okay, so it's a completely useful source. I mean, if you don't want to go to jail, you probably don't want to do that, but you know, it's a great useful source if you can, you know, get what you want is available there, but it has a very high latency. Okay, so then the issue would become, how do you trade off coverage, which is recall, with cost of execution of the plan? Notice I only said coverage, which corresponds to recall. I should say, if I say coverage, I should also say something else, right? I mean, if I say recall, I should say something else. What is that? Precision. I'm acting as if these sources went to the real database that existed, filled up their, you know, sources with the database tuples. That's not the way internet works, actually. Some people make up information. Some people have corrupted the information. So you want to know who is the director of a certain movie, and this source with high confidence says, so for example, who made Godfather? With high confidence it says Woody Allen made Godfather. And if you knew the answer and you're just testing the source, I'm sure you would say, are you fake? But most people who ask a query are not interested in just testing the sources. They want the answers. Now how do you know that it's the wrong answer? Do you understand what I'm saying? So in fact, one of the interesting issues is coverage is not enough. You need to talk about precision, which is the correctness of the results. Okay? Now, here is the interesting thing. All of this can be done. There are interesting inference problems. First of all, because there are multiple dimensions of optimization, it's a multi-objective optimization. It's a hard enough problem there. You need to talk about Pareto sets, you need to talk about dominance, etc. Or you need to talk about how to combine alpha times this plus beta times this plus gamma times this, where alpha plus beta plus gamma hopefully adds up to one, some sort of a convex combination. Okay, there's an inference problem. But before you get to the inference problem, you need to have estimates of expected time of execution, expected rate at which tuples will come, expected coverage of the source, expected correctness of the source. So if you are a web oriented mediator, what is the chance that the sources will happily, voluntarily give correct information about their statistics when they have no correctness on the data? It's an adversarial situation. First of all, they probably won't even care that you are mediating over them. So remember, I pointed out one of the interesting dimensions is cooperative versus autonomous sources. In fact, I can say cooperative versus autonomous versus adversarial sources. Okay, they say, my God, you guys are making money. I'm going to stop you from making money. I mean, Google did it lots of times. Anytime any meta search engine will try to put Google as one of the sources it calls, a meta search engine is a sort of a search mediator. So all that Google has to do is block the IP. Why should you make the money? I want to make the money. Okay, or I'll start sending wrong results to you, even better. Then you'll be going out of business much faster. Okay, adversarialness is part and parcel of the web. So there are two issues that came up. One is, the first issue, of course, is how do you get these statistics? Okay, they're not going to, and you can say, let the sources tell me how complete they are. In fact, the first ideas were like this, and I will talk about something, you know, some you know, situations where if the sources tell you how complete they are, you can use that to stop calling them sometimes. Or once you call them, you won't call others. But then this is sort of a la-la land where sources are so well-behaved that they're just, their only interest in life is to help the mediator. That's not web. Okay? So what you need to do is you need to learn the statistics. Okay, and so you need to learn execution time, latency statistics, you need to learn the rate statistics, you need to learn the coverage statistics, and you need to learn the correctness statistics. And in fact, of all the things, the correctness statistics are tricky too. In fact, one of the issues is, I mean, in fact, one can say that the correctness and the robustness and the consistency, all these things can be combined into a general idea called the quality of the source. and you need to assess the quality of the source. And in some sense, it could be a global measure. And what's more interesting is that anybody can count the number of answers they got for a query. Okay, if they didn't know the answer to that query, they can't tell how many of those answers are actually right. Do you understand what I'm saying? Relevance is different from correctness. Okay, so I am searching for who made Godfather. There is a page which says, you want to know who made Godfather? And so I click on it. Isn't it relevant for me? Yes, it is relevant for me. It says Woody Allen and his brother made it. So what am I supposed to do at this point? I have to take it at the face value. I should know before clicking that this is a source that can't be trusted. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is sort of a source trustworthiness. And you need to assess it in a global context of other sources somehow. Such that, since it's adversarial, if there is an easy way of assessing the trustworthiness, it can also be easily stamped. Okay, so you need to come up with measures for computing the quality, for example, which would not be easy to spam. Okay, the kind of measures that you must be thinking of at this time would be looking like what? Yeah, because that's one of the measures that can't be easily spammed. So something which somehow cannot be easily spammed. Okay? Now, so basically the whole point of this discussion is that there are multiple objectives and you're trying to optimize all of them together. To do optimization with respect to these, you need multi-objective optimization or some specialization of it which combines all of them into a single objective. But even before you can actually plug numbers into it, you need the numbers. That means you need to learn the statistics. There's learning and inference, but it's all being done in the context of optimization now, not in the context of just calling sources. I mean, not in the context of reformulation, but in the optimization. Okay, so I will talk about a small problem called source selection problem. Okay, which basically is assuming all sources are exporting the fragments of the same relation. So by that time, we have taken care of the schema mapping problem. We have taken care of whether it is horizontal or vertical. What is it? If they're all exporting the fragments of the same relation, then you can think of it as basically a vertical integration. Okay. And then, so a fragment may have either fewer columns or fewer rows. That means either they have some of the books missing. If it's a book database, some of the books might be missing. Some sources may not give the number of pages in the book. Some sources may not give the ISBN number of the book. Okay, if you're thinking of papers, computer science papers, some of them might not give AI papers, only give database papers. And I think I mentioned it to you. I mean, the DBLP source is extremely fast in indexing every possible third-rate database paper, okay? But they are not as fast in indexing AI papers, okay? But DBLP, the source, gives BibTeX information for each source, which is like a useful piece of information for a source. But Google Scholar doesn't, at least not the last I checked. Okay, so then if you have that, then the main query optimization issue is source selection. How do you select sources to answer a query? Okay, which needs to optimize some constraint on the time of execution, rate, coverage, etc. Okay, the objective is call the least number of sources that sort of give the most number of high quality tuples in the least amount of time, if you just only care about those metrics. But in general, what you're saying is, call me K sources which optimizes the following optimization function, which is defined in terms of these features. Okay? So, in doing this, you're already saying, because one of the features is coverage, you might say, to get me 90% coverage, what's the best plan, which involves 5 sources? Okay, so I would actually ignore pretty much everything for now. I'll ignore the latency, I'll ignore the rate, I'll ignore the source quality, and just consider a very simple aspect of this problem, which is, just give me K k sources that have the highest coverage. That is, they will give the maximum number of results for my problem. So I have decided the k. I want 5 sources to be called. I only have money to call 5 sources. Tell me which 5 sources should I call such that I'll get the maximum number of answers to my query. Okay? Now, it turns out that even, so anyway, this is actually sort of a repetition of the previous one. It turns out that even in the case of just interest in getting the maximum number of tuples, it's not, first of all, you need to know statistics about the sources. You need to know for each source the expected number of results that it's going to send me given a query of this type. Okay, there is no such thing as 100% coverage. It may be it's 100% coverage for databases, 90% coverage for AI, and even if it's like a CS paper database, okay? And then maybe 30% coverage for something else. Okay, suppose first of all, I need to learn that, because nobody is going to tell me. If you ask the sources, they will say, yes, we'll give you all the database, all the papers. Okay, so you need to sort of estimate these coverages. Furthermore, you also need to estimate the overlap between sources. Why? Because getting 2 copies of the same result doesn't normally get you anything. Sometimes you may want to get 2 copies of the same result. Why? Because it turns out that, so normally you don't care about more than 1 copy of the same result. So you are interested in reducing the overlap. But there are special kind of cases where what you want is to increase the overlap, because you wound up getting a partially specified tuple from one source, and you want to get the same tuple from a different source such that hopefully the missing columns here are present there. So you will get a more complete view of the tuple. So for example, I can combine DBLP and Google Scholar so that I will get both the BibTeX information and everything else. And so, and especially in fact, if you combine the DBLP and CypeSeer, you will get both PDF file for the paper and the BibTeX information. So that would be a classic, that would be an example of, you know, increasing the completeness of individual tuples. Okay? But the point, of course, is that you need to learn this coverage and overlap statistics. And in general, these statistics depend upon the query. Okay? So the question, of course, is what's a reasonable way of computing these statistics? And second question is, if I give you those statistics, what is the complexity of finding k sources that have the maximum number of answers? If I told you, for example, coverage and overlap statistics between sources, then, and I told you, get me k sources that will give the maximum coverage, it turns out that that problem is NP-hard. Why is it NP-hard? Because it turns out that essentially the overlap between the sources would change the order in which you are supposed to call the sources. You can't just call, suppose the first source to call, let's say, is the one which has 80% coverage for this query. Now the second source to call is not necessarily the one which has 79% coverage with this query, if in fact the 79% coverage completely overlaps with these 80%. You need to get somebody else, which may be only 13% coverage, but that 13% is completely new tuple. So in general, if you look at it as a normal theoretical problem, essentially computing the optimal k sources, given all the statistics, is NP-hard. So what you would wind up doing actually is a greedy algorithm, which could be far away from the optimum. Okay. Now what the greedy algorithm would do would be at least take overlap into consideration in in picking the next source. Okay. Let me see if I can show you that. No, not here. So the way the greedy So the way the greedy algorithm would work is it would compute the residual coverage for every source given the set of sources we have already decided to call. In the beginning, that set is 0, that set is empty. Okay, so that means all residual coverage is the same as the coverage. Okay, and having called one source, for example, if you have already called CSB, which is the computer science bibliography source, now you are interested in computing the coverage of DBLP source for this query, knowing that you already called CSB source. You want the new tuples that are not included in the CSB. Okay, that can be essentially written as the DBLP given Q. Now you can think of this coverage as a probability. The probability that a random tuple, this probability is the probability that a random set tuple which is an answer to the query Q is actually present in DBLP. And if that's one, that means every answer to this query is present in the source. So when I say I want to compute the statistics, I want to compute these probabilities. Okay? So this probability now of the residual coverage of DBLP given that you have already called CSB is the original coverage of DBLP with respect to the query Q minus any tuples that are present in CSB and DBLP. Okay? So you need to compute this. So you not only need to estimate this probability, you need to estimate this joint probability. Now the interesting thing, of course, is that whenever you have a conjunctive probability, what would you try to do to make your life simple? Assume independence. So if you assume independence, if you assume that the sources are independently formulated, then the probability that a tuple is present both in CSB and DBLP is nothing but probability that is present in CSB times the probability that it's present in DBLP. So for the special case of independent distribution of tuples over sources, then you would actually be able to get by with fewer statistics. Basically, you just need the coverage statistics. What's the worst possible case? If you don't want to do the special case, in the worst possible case, actually you might be asking for the probability that DBLP given Q and CSB and source 2 and source 3 and source 4 and source 5. Then what happens is essentially you are trying to compute union from intersections. So what you would wind up is you would do minus of a probability, plus of another probability, minus another probability, plus another probability for all possible subsets of the sources, where each of these probabilities would be, so in this case, it's a 2-ary joint probability, or 3-ary joint probability, or n-ary joint probability. Okay? You can make your life simple, for example, in computing these by saying, I will estimate the joints by either assuming independence or assuming at most binary dependence. So A and B and C, if I assume independence, then it will be A times B times C. If I assume at most binary dependence, then A and B and C would be computed in terms of A and B, B and C, and A and C. So you need one less statistic. Okay. The point, of course, is we are getting into sub-problems of the overall optimization techniques, and there too there is interesting work going on in terms of just estimating these statistics and using them. Okay. So if I do this residual coverage, if I do this residual coverage, and then I pick the next source to be the one with the highest residual coverage, that would be a greedy algorithm. That won't be optimal, but it's better than just going by direct coverage. The reason I'm going into this depth is, again, there's one more homework question on this. Okay? So those of you who have already were asleep, you have to remember that this is a part of the lecture you have to go to. I should actually charge you for the audio today, because I think I can make some money at least today. But anyway, so the interesting point is that you can actually compute these statistics and you can use them in deciding which subset of sources to call. Okay? Even though it all looked like it's just high-level architecture issues, as you dig down, there are specific technical problems that you need to solve. The other interesting point I wanted to mention, so this is basically the learning source statistics in general is essentially a tricky issue, because in the best case you want the statistics for the specific query that you have on hand. But if you do that, you need to learn large number of statistics for the queries. In fact, you need to have computed the statistics for every query and then wait for that query to be asked, which makes sort of no sense, right? Because in fact, one simple way of computing the top k sources to call, given a query, is to call all million sources. Okay, wait, I'm trying to figure out. So I'll call all million sources, find out all the tuples they gave, find out all the overlaps between them, figure out which five of them should have been called such that I would have got the maximum number of tuples. And then say, these are the five I want to call. It's dumb because basically you did the million source calling up front. Okay, now you could say, well, I don't need to do it online. I'll just do for every query the optimal k sources up front, and then I'll just have to table lookup. Okay, that is just as dumb. It just pushes the dumbness into past. Okay, what you really need is some way of thinking of query statistics with respect, the statistics with respect to query classes rather than individual queries. So I don't want to say that DBLP has something against me. They don't have my papers. That may well be true. Okay, but what I would like to do is talk about statistics such as DBLP seems to be 80% complete for AI queries and 99% complete for database queries. The issue, of course, is you need to learn this online with respect to training queries. Okay, I'll flash some slides without going into details, but you can go, maybe next time I'll show you, depending on my, depending on the time. But here is a little thing that I think Nie, who actually came and talked before last time, when he was a grad student here, he did a system called BibFinder, which essentially was a direct data aggregation system. It was looking for all bibliography sources online, and it was trying to combine them, and when the source, when the query comes, it tries to decide what subsets of queries the sources to call to get the maximum coverage, given the number of sources is limited. Okay? And so he had to deal with this, and what he wound up doing, and in fact, when he came here, he talked about Libra. Libra essentially is a data warehouse approach for the same problem, where he gets all the bibliography data, puts it in the Microsoft database, whereas BibFinder was going to existing databases without copying the data, just doing it only on the query time. Okay, the thing that he does is, the way he wound up doing it, is he will start with a bunch of training queries up front. For those training queries, you can do what I said, which is call all the sources and actually compute the exact coverages and overlaps of all possible orders for those queries, because you can do this for those training queries. And the next question, of course, is go from here to a query hierarchy, a query class hierarchy. Okay? So what I really want to do is imagine that I have a bunch of queries here at the bottom level, and you, as you go up, they become more generalized queries. Okay? And so he might have the answers, the exact answers to some of the specific queries, but as you're going up, you're trying to compute, estimate the statistics for the classes in terms of the statistics you have for the lower level queries. To do this, it turns out that he wound up doing something that I won't at least mention to you because you can again actually make sense of it. He has to, it turns out that this looks like some sort of a clustering algorithm, right? What kind of a clustering does it look like? Hierarchical agglomerative clustering. Okay, so upfront it looks like if I give you some number of queries, then I can do some sort of a hierarchical agglomerative clustering to compute the query hierarchy, and then I can just remember the statistics for them. It turns out that for some interesting technical reasons, the better way to do is to not compute this directly, but compute the attribute value hierarchy. So that means think in terms of conferences and their generalized, you know, fields. Okay, and then if you have that, and the years and their generalized fields. So here is the year hierarchy, and here is the conference hierarchy. Sigmod and ICDE are sort of part of a super node, which you and I might call DB, databases, but it's just a super node for the guy who actually does the clustering. And then similarly, triple I and ECP is part of some super node, which is again part of a full super node. And then the query hierarchy here is just a cross product of these two hierarchies. And you can compute these using agglomerative clustering. And the only last point I want you to understand before going off is, if you want to do clustering, what do you need? Distance measure. Everybody can do clustering. All they need is distance measure. What would be the right way to define the distance measure when your interest is to calculate this hierarchy? The right way is basically you're trying to figure out essentially how are the tuples, which are answers for this class of queries, distributed among the sources. If two queries have the same distribution over the sources, then they are close. It's not the question of AI and databases, it turns out. DBLP would keep track of Sigmod as well as AAAI. AAAI is the top conference in AI. Sigmod is the top conference in database. AI and databases don't have too much common, but they are similar in terms of the way bibliography sources keep track of their tuples. Everybody wants to keep track of the top conference in each area. Okay, so to do this, I define the distance measure itself in terms of the coverages. Okay? In terms of the coverages and overlaps. And once you do that, I can compute my agglomerative hierarchical clustering. And then I can do the Cartesian product, and I'll have a query hierarchy. Okay? So that's one way you could have computed statistics for that. Similarly, you can compute statistics for latency measures. And when I come back next class, I'll say a little about how you might compute statistics on the quality or trust measures, because I have to go back now and help my student write that paper. And so once I write it, whether they actually take the paper or not, I'll at least tell you how we plan to do it. Okay?